This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There are best practices that people have come up with that could stop these nurdles from getting into the environment, you know? And the problem is that none of the plastic companies have any incentive to clean them up.
What is a nurdle, you ask? Is it the latest variation on the popular New York Times puzzle Wordle? No, not quite. Nurdles are the tiny little petroleum-based building blocks of the plastics industry. And they're literally everywhere. This week on Sea Change Radio, we dig into the archives and talk to Neil Dinesha of Vox to learn about the role nurdles play in the $500 billion global plastics industry and why they're a big problem for the environment. Then we hear about a small, innovative company that's recycling all sorts of plastics and turning them into gravel. We speak to the founder and CEO Sebastian Sajou about the technology and mission of his company, ArcLight. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Neil Dinesha. Neil is a climate and tech reporter for Vox. Neil, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a piece on May 5th that came out in Vox about nurdles. And I had never heard this term before, but I'm sure I've seen them and I'm sure they're in my life as we speak. They're everywhere. So first, what is a nurdle?
So a nurdle is a lentil-sized piece of pre-production plastic. It's it's usually this little white orb that's produced in the trillions every year by petrochemical companies around the world. And then they're used as essentially the building block of all plastic products. So they are melted down at factories and then put into casts or molds, and out will pop, a water bottle or a steering wheel or a sewage pipe.
And the name sounds like somebody just made it up like a widget, but do you have any etymology on the word nurdle? How long has this term been around?
That is a great question. Everyone I asked has been kind of confused by this. So nurdle is not the proper name for these things. The real name for these things are pre-production plastic pellets or resins is what the petrochemical industry calls them. But the word nurdle just seems to have come out of nowhere. When I looked into the etymology, one of the possible sources is the wave-shaped gob of toothpaste you see on oral care packaging. Colgate and GlaxoSmithKline actually went to court over this a few years ago. That was the word that they used for that little piece of toothpaste on packaging.
They didn't want to call it a thingamabob.
Yeah, exactly. So they called it a nurdle. And then and then somehow that sound made its way over to these plastic pellets. And when you look at them, you can sort of see why they're called nurdles. They're weird little objects that, you would sort of make up a nonsense word for because you don't really know what else to call it. And I guess that's sort of how it stuck. If someone was like, that's a nurdle.
All right. So let's talk about the dark side of these nurdles. They're produced in the trillions, as you mentioned, and, mm-hmm. and you would think that these beaded forms are fairly easy to transport and keep from seeping into the environment because they would just be used on an industrial level to melt down, as you mentioned, but that's not the case. They really have kind of inserted themselves into far more flora and fauna than I'm sure their manufacturers intended.
That's right. Nurdles are escaping from the production process constantly. An estimated, I believe it's 200,000 metric tons of nurdles are estimated or escape into the environment every year. That adds up to about 10 trillion nurdles because they're so light. They're only about 20 milligrams. And like you said, manufacturers never intended for them to be in the environment. That's not what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to end up at a factory somewhere. but manufacturers also don't seem to care enough to stop them from getting into waterways, which is usually how they get into the environment. You know, they're spilling out in all kinds of ways. They could be spilling out of bags in transit. They could be falling out of rail cars, out of shipping containers. They're getting out there all the time.
So we should mention that they're made by petrochemicals. Why don't you explain the building blocks of these nurdles, the building blocks themselves?
Yes. So the basic way that they're made is that a company will take oil or natural gas, and through a process called cracking, they'll turn it into something like ethylene, which, you know, they then will turn into a long spaghetti-like tube of plastic, which then they chop into thousands of tiny little pieces, which turn into nurdles. And so all of these things are, you know, oil and gas byproducts, which, yeah, eventually turn into the plastic products we use every day.
And are there any gradations of nurdles in terms of when you mention drink bottles, you hear about plastics that are BPA-free or something like that? Are there BPA-free nurdles, for example?
Yes. So, you know, all those things that you hear, you know, whether BPA-free or BPH-free, that's dependent upon the composition of the nurdles themselves, right? So all these nurdles come in, they're made of different kinds of polymers. So they all look the same, but the actual composition of them can vary, you know, per instance or per manufacturer. So definitely there are different kinds of nurdles if you want to get down into the nitty-gritty of it. And one of my sources, when I was reporting on this story, actually analyzes different kinds of nurdles that he finds in the environment to see what they're made of. And he's trying to build a database of all these different kinds of nurdles. So he's been seeing these variations on the regular.
And how do they differ from other microplastics, notably like these microbeads that we heard a lot about being banned in, I think they were in shampoos and things like that back in the day?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I guess to begin with, microbeads are sort of, at the end of the day, probably made out of nurdles or something like them. But nurdles themselves, from the beginning, when they're manufactured, they are microplastics because they're less than 5 millimeters in diameter. So to begin with, they're actually the second largest source of microplastics because of just, despite like the nature of their existence, like, you know, just from the beginning, they're microplastics.
So what's the number one source of microplastics pollution? Is it these degraded larger plastics?
The number one source of microplastics is actually tire dust. And that's a whole other story, which I did not get into in my story, but it's definitely interesting. And then nurdles are the second largest source of microplastics. And when I say they're the second largest source, part of it is because so many of them are getting into the environment, but also because they do break down themselves over time. So they're already small, and so they're already microplastics, and then they break down even further, and they turn into even smaller pieces of plastic that then, you know, make their way into things like our bloodstream. You know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, nurdles are all pre-production materials. Most microplastics that we see nowadays are the result of are the result of consumer materials or post-production materials that have then, you know, been improperly disposed of and then broken down. So, you know, a water bottle, for example, could break down into smaller microplastics over time. That plastic before it turns into that plastic, if that makes sense.
Neon mouth with a bling of soft smile, nothing but an electric sign. You could say she has an individual style, she's a part of a carnival time. Super steel lady, chrome covered clothes you wear, cause you have no other. But I suppose no one knows you're my plastic fantastic lover.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Neil Dinesha. He is a tech and climate reporter for Vox. So, Neil, you were talking about how these nurdles, these building blocks of the microplastic world or of the plastic world, how they begin as microplastics, and but they don't degrade. They're just there in the form that they were produced, and then they kind of escape from the manufacturing process. To me, that would signal that there's more hope on the nurdle front, that we can kind of harness this pollutant easier than some of the plastics that degrade. Is that an overly optimistic viewpoint, or is that realistic?
No, I think that's totally realistic. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the reason these things are escaping is because of, you know, gaps in the manufacturing process, right? Like, and it's always through really mundane little ways. You know, they're slipping around rail cars, they're falling out of cracks, literally they're falling out of cracks, or they're like, you know, falling into drains somewhere at a factory. And there are best practices that people have come up with that could stop these nurdles from getting into the environment, you know? And the problem is that none of the plastic companies have any incentive to clean them up, because it's just cheaper to let them keep spilling than to install the barriers or the fixes that would need to be installed to stop them from leaking into the environment in the first place.
What are some of the examples of better practices that could stop them from leaking?
I mean, these are so, like I said, these are so mundane. So for example, nurdles are blown into rail cars using these pneumatic hoses. And when they're not properly attached to the rail car, they can spill out around the edges of the hoses. And so one fix is just put a tray under the rail car's loading area that would catch the nurdles as they fall off. And then you can, you know, reuse those nurdles into the next loading of the rail car instead of letting them spill onto the ground and then getting washed away or blown away.
So it's just a toaster tray, basically, under the rail car?
Yeah, something as simple as that. I mean, I guess it would be a large tray, but, you know, it's a tray at the end of the day. Or you could put, you know, a mesh grill on a drain that would stop the nurdles from getting through. And then someone would have to come through and empty the grill every now and then. But, you know, it's just a simple little fix here and there. Or the bags that are used to transport nurdles during shipping could be toughened so that they don't split apart as easily, so that, you know, the nurdles won't escape.
So you mentioned this 2020 New Orleans spill that you were investigating, Neil. What other major nurdle incidents have there been in terms of spills around the globe?
Yeah, I mean, last year in 2021, there was a major spill off the coast of Sri Lanka when a tanker carrying, you know, millions or billions, it's still kind of unknown, these nurdles sank off the coast of Sri Lanka. And it caused what the United Nations called the biggest plastic spill in history. You know, if you look at the pictures from the spill, you just see these beaches coated in white nurdles, and there are these really striking photos of people trying to clean them up and animals crawling across them and fish filled with nurdles. And it kind of highlights just sort of how messy this whole thing is. They're just so hard to clean up, and also there's no control over these, you know, whether internationally or locally in the United States. You know, these things have gone entirely unregulated, and no one knows who's supposed to clean them up or has any control over stopping them from spilling in the first place.
Neil Dinesha, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much, Alex.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the founder and CEO of ArcLight, Sebastian Sajou. Sebastian, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here.
So we'll get into the technology in a second, Sebastian, but first, what's the mission of ArcLight?
Well, our mission is to tackle plastic pollution. So we work on developing technologies to achieve this. And we do it by partnering with bigger organizations, by industry leaders, but also with the society. I don't know if you're aware, but every time you drop a piece of plastic on the bin, half of that, it's still going to end up in a landfill, on an incineration, or in the worst case, you know, on a water course and contaminating the environment. So that 50% of plastics that no one wants, that's our raw material. And our first product, that it's the one we're producing here in California, it's a smart gravel that replaces mineral gravel in a variety of applications. right? We count on everyone going out there and buying a bag of RTI Smart Gravel is automatically deviating all those pounds of plastics from the environment.
And you have kind of a multi-stage rollout plan for it. Why don't you kind of explain? Right now, you're going to be available for smaller consumer purchases, but it's going to be ramping up to bigger construction scale soon, right?
Yeah, totally. So when we started working on this solution, we were aiming for a large-scale solution for a large-scale problem. That's why we got to this idea of making gravel, right? So gravel has a great variety of applications and very different markets. From, let's say, starting from the bigger markets, you have concrete companies that are interested in making light concrete. So they replace the mineral gravel in the concrete mix by our gravel to get lighter materials and also the better insulative capacity of plastics in there, while also being able to offer a green concrete to their customers. Then you have like mid-sized markets, like the, for example, hydroponic growers that are using our gravel as a replacement of expanded clay because it's a great growth media for those systems. And then we also offer it on smaller bags on retail. It's already on the big box retailers. For small home gardening projects, for also small hydroponics projects, and also small contractors using the gravel. So you'll see it online on the big retailers, and you can also see it maybe, you know, on a big Cemex concrete truck just on the road.
Now let's dive into the process of upcycling that ArcLight has developed. Why don't you kind of walk us through how it might work from somebody using a plastic container that gets rejected by their waste management company and how it might get into your company's hands and how you'd utilize it.
Yeah, sure. So we get the plastics from two main streams. One is post-industrial, and that is manufacturers of different types of plastics that are in the... That are non-recyclable, and for that I could say potato chips bags, I don't know, cookies, wrappers for energy bars, all those films that we see on the products that we eat, for example, every day, because they have several layers of different plastics that protect the product for a longer time. So they're already born unrecyclable. So the more, environmentally aware companies manufacturing these materials, they don't want to send all the scrap, all the leftovers to a landfill, so they send it to us. And same thing happens on the post-consumer side, where we partner with MRFs and with other recyclers that are picking the good plastics that have a commodity value, and then they have no other choice than sending those plastics to the remaining plastics to a landfill, right? So we do offer that as a service. So it's pretty special because we have a double revenue model where we charge for the solution and we compete against a landfill, and we offer a price competitive option and a sustainable option at the end of the day. Just to give you a general idea of what happens with those plastics when they get here, we classify them, we grind all the plastics, we clean them, we remove any leftovers of organics or any other contaminants that they may have, and then we heat them at really high temperatures to remove any other bacteria. So we stabilize the plastic, and at the end of the day, at the end of the process, you get this gravel which is stabilized, and that assures that it will be long-lasting, that it won't leach anything, that it won't break down into microplastics. And of course, this is not easy. It took us 5 years to develop the technology, but now, yeah, we can tell that we turn trash into a long-lasting, sustainable product.
And in terms of application, is this gravel different than other gravel? Like, can it not be used in highways, etc.?
Well, the main difference is there are two main differences. One is weight. right? This is very, very light. So compared to mineral gravel that is really heavy, we can offer that benefit. And that's, of course, useful if you're looking for that. If you want to do, for example, a light concrete, then you want to replace mineral gravel with our gravel. But if you are looking for example, compressive strength, then you want to go for mineral gravel, standard gravel, because there's nothing, you know, harder than that. So we offer flexibility, which is very much appreciated in civil engineering applications, lightweight and great insulation. So depending on the use you want to do for it, there, for example, there's people just buying the gravel because just going to the store, grabbing a 50 liter or a big bag of gravel, it's very heavy, it's very difficult to transport, to handle, and even to install. It's also dirty. And when you buy our smart gravel, you can carry a couple of bags because it's three times lighter. It's clean. And at the end of the day, you are helping the environment. So that's kind of, depending on what you're doing, how you will be able to benefit from it.
And in terms of procuring the plastics, you mentioned how you can get like these films that might get thrown away otherwise. How do you compete with like the landfills for these products? How do you ensure that you can get a steady flow, a steady supply of these recyclable plastics?
Well, first of all, economics. We charge less than a landfill. So that's one of the main difference between our technologies and other technologies out there. We are very cost efficient. So that's the main driver. And also companies sending those plastics to us, besides maybe saving a penny, they get access to incentives, to subsidies or tax credits or other benefits that are associated with their industry because they are improving their sustainability metrics. So it's a win, however you look at it.
Take some rocks in gravel, baby. Make a solid road. Make a solid road. Take some rocks in
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Sebastian Sajou. He is the founder and CEO of ArcLite. People can go to ArcLite, that's ArcLite.com to check it out. So the gravel itself can be used for what exactly? Is this something that people would put into their gardens or their driveways or what?
Well, just to mention a couple of applications, let's say you're growing hydroponics with a hydroponic system, you use expanded clay as a growth media. So the plants will grab from the expanded clay and they will grow, feeding from the water that runs through that expanded clay. If you replace that expanded clay, which is a traditional system, with our gravel, then you'll get a clean system because this gravel, our gravel won't break down into smaller parts or won't generate any dust, keeping all the systems clean. And on top of that, because it's not porous, if you ever get like some type of pest in the water, you just remove it, wash it, and you can reuse it many times compared to expanded clay, where you would need to just toss all the expanded clay and buy a new batch and install it again. So that's, for example, hydroponics. And then home gardening, the most traditional use is to help avoid root rot, which is something very common among people that loves gardening. And so you want, if you set a layer of smart gravel at the bottom of your pots, then you will allow the water to drain more efficiently out of the pot and your plants will grow bigger and healthier. So That's for the most common home applications.
So, Sebastian, you were mentioning how you have different product offerings at a different scale level on the horizon. Are there any plans for your company to expand the range of plastics that can be recycled?
So the crazy thing here is that we are already recycling every type of plastic. And the magic of the technology is that we can mix everything together and turn that into a new plastic polymer that we can mold into different things. So maybe the challenge is not adding new plastics, but adding new products to the products that we are offering. So because we're already related and working a lot with the construction industry, with landscapers and architects and urban developers, we're already working on new products for those categories, like other fibers to be used for concretes, blocks for emergency housing, and ready-mix concrete, so you can make a light and an eco-friendly ready-mix at home. So there are other things that we're working in partnerships with bigger companies that are leaders in the market.
And can you kind of give us a snapshot of the competitive landscape? You have your own technology, but there are other companies that take plastic and use it for industrial purposes. Do you work directly with the waste management company or not?
Well, yes, we work with them because the process begins with an analysis of the plastics available, the amount of plastic they have, how contaminated they are. So we do tailor a solution for them and then work on a long-term agreement so we can both get benefited from the relationship. And I would say that at this point, we are the only ones taking these unrecyclable or, let's say, hard to recycle plastics and processing them at a rate of 1 ton per hour and turning that into an efficient product for a massive market. So we have covered all the angles because we have a good technology. We have a market that doesn't generate any bottleneck for the product, which is sometimes something that affects great ideas, because then the market maybe is not ready for the final product resulting of a great technology. And the other thing would be the low cost, because all other technologies out there which are great, like really, really amazing, like the polymerizing the plastics and other things like that, then they are still in a lab scale and they're very, very expensive. So it's still, you know, they're a little bit green yet, and they are where we were 5 years ago when we started.
He's the CEO and founder of ArcLite. People can go to ARQLITE.com to learn more. Sebastian Sajou. Sebastian, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks to you, Alex. Pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Hot 8 Brass Band, Jefferson Airplane, and Bob Dylan. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week, as we continue making connections for sustainability. For SeaChange Radio, I'm Alex Wise.